personal ethics, managerial ethics, business ethics, medical ethics that I've ever heard articulated, the retired general gushed. Parloff didn't end up using those quotes in his article, but the ringing endorsements he heard in interview after interview from the luminaries on Theranos's board gave him confidence that Elizabeth was the real deal. He also liked to think of himself as a pretty good judge of character. After all, he'd dealt with his share of dishonest people over the years, having worked in the prison during law school, and later writing at length about such fraudsters as the carpet-cleaning entrepreneur Barry Minko and the lawyer Mark Dreyer, both of whom went to prison for masterminding Ponzi schemes. Sure, Elizabeth had a secretive streak when it came to discussing certain specifics about her company, but he found her for the most part to be genuine and sincere. Since his angle was no longer the patent case, he didn't bother to reach out to the Fuses. When Parloff's cover story was published in the June 12, 2014 issue of Fortune, it vaulted Elizabeth to instant stardom. Her journal interview had gotten some notice, and there had also been a piece in Wired, but there was nothing like a magazine cover to grab people's attention, especially when that cover featured an attractive young woman wearing a black turtleneck, dark mascara around her piercing blue eyes, and bright red lipstick, next to the catchy headline, "This CEO is out for blood." The story disclosed Theranos's valuation for the first time, as well as the fact that Elizabeth owned more than half of the company. There was also the now familiar comparison to Steve Jobs and Bill Gates. This time, it came not from George Shultz, but from her old Stanford professor, Channing Robertson. Had Parloff read Robertson's testimony in the Fuse trial, he would have learned that Theranos was paying him $500,000 a year, ostensibly as a consultant. Parloff also included a passage about Elizabeth's phobia of needles, a detail that would be repeated over and over in the ensuing flurry of coverage his story unleashed and become central to her myth. When the editors at Forbes saw the Fortune article, they immediately assigned reporters to confirm the company's valuation and the size of Elizabeth's ownership stake and ran a story about her in their next issue. Under the headline, "Bloody Amazing," the article pronounced her the youngest woman to become a self-made billionaire. 2 months later, she graced one of the covers of the magazine's annual Forbes 400 issue on the richest people in America. More fawning stories followed in USA Today, Inc., Fast Company, and Glamour, along with segments on NPR, Fox Business, CNBC, CNN, and CBS News. With the explosion of media coverage came invitations to numerous conferences and a cascade of accolades. Elizabeth became the youngest person to win the Horatio Alger Award. Time magazine named her one of the 100 most influential people in the world. President Obama appointed her a U.S. ambassador for global entrepreneurship, and Harvard Medical School invited her to join its prestigious Board of Fellows. As much as she courted the attention, Elizabeth's sudden fame wasn't entirely her doing. Her emergence tapped into the public's hunger to see a female entrepreneur break through in a technology world dominated by men. Women like Yahoo's Marissa Meyer and Facebook's Sheryl Sandberg had achieved a measure of renown in Silicon Valley, but they hadn't created their own companies from scratch. In Elizabeth Holmes, the Valley had its first female billionaire tech founder. Still, there was something unusual in the way Elizabeth embraced the limelight. She behaved more like a movie star than an entrepreneur, basking in the public adulation she was receiving. Each week brought a new media interview or conference appearance. Other well-known startup founders gave interviews and made public appearances too, but with nowhere near the same frequency. The image of the reclusive, ascetic young woman Parloff had been sold on had overnight given way to that of the ubiquitous celebrity. Elizabeth was also quick to embrace the trappings of fame. The Theranos security team grew to 20 people. 2 bodyguards now drove her around in a black Audi A8 sedan. Their codename for her was Eagle One. Sunny was Eagle Two. The Audi had no license plates, another nod to Steve Jobs, who used to lease a new Mercedes every 6 months to avoid having plates. Elizabeth also had a personal chef who prepared her salads and green vegetable juices made of cucumber, parsley, kale, spinach, lettuce, and celery. And when she had to fly somewhere, it was in a private Gulfstream jet. Part of what made Elizabeth's persona so compelling was her heartwarming message about using Theranos' convenient blood tests to catch diseases early so that, as she put it in interview after interview, no one would have to say goodbye to loved ones too soon. In September 2014, 3 months after the Fortune cover story, she made that message more poignant during a speech at the TED-Med conference in San Francisco by adding a personal dimension to it. For the first time, she told the story in public of her uncle who had died of cancer. The same story Tyler Schultz had found so inspiring when he'd started working at Theranos. It was true that Elizabeth's uncle, Ron Dietz, had died 18 months earlier from skin cancer that had metastasized and spread to his brain. But what she omitted to disclose was that she had never been close to him. To family members who knew the reality of their relationship, using his death to promote her company felt phony and exploitative. Of course, no one in the audience at San Francisco's Palace of Fine Arts knew this. Most of the 1,000 spectators in attendance found her performance mesmerizing. Clad all in black, she strode solemnly around the stage as she spoke, like a preacher giving a sermon. In a stunt that made for brilliant theater, she pulled a nanotainer out of her jacket pocket midway through and held it up to illustrate how little blood Theranos' tests required. Calling the fear of needles one of the basic human fears, up there with the fear of spiders and the fear of heights. She then told other touching anecdotes. One was about a little girl who got stuck repeatedly with a syringe by a hospital nurse who couldn't find her vein. Another was about cancer patients whose spirits were broken by all the blood they had to give as part of their treatments. One of the people watching from a seat halfway up the auditorium was Patrick O'Neill, whom Elizabeth had hired away from TBWA Chiat Day and appointed Theranos' chief creative officer. Patrick had become instrumental in honing Elizabeth's image and raising her profile. He had helped her prepare for the conference, and before that, had worked with Fortune's photographer on the magazine's cover shoot. To Patrick, making Elizabeth the face of Theranos made perfect sense. She was the company's most powerful marketing tool. Her story was intoxicating. Everyone wanted to believe in it, including the numerous young girls who were sending her letters and emails. It wasn't a cynical calculus on his part. Patrick was one of her biggest believers. He had no knowledge of the shenanigans in the lab and didn't pretend to understand the science of blood testing. As far as he was concerned, the fairy tale was real. Before he became a full-time employee, Elizabeth had hung inspirational quotes in little frames around the old Facebook building. One of them was from Michael Jordan. "I've missed more than 9,000 shots in my career. I've lost almost 300 games. 26 times, I've been trusted to take the game-winning shot and missed. I've failed over and over and over again in my life. And that is why I succeed." Another was from Theodore Roosevelt. "Far and away, the best prize that life has to offer is the chance to work hard at work worth doing." Patrick suggested they make them a more integral part of the workplace by painting them in black on the building's white walls. Elizabeth liked the idea. She also loved a new quote he suggested. It was from Yoda in Star Wars. "Do or do not. There is no try." She had it painted in huge capital letters in the building's entrance. To accommodate its swelling ranks, which now totaled more than 500, Theranos was planning to move to a new location it had leased from Stanford, a few blocks away, on Page Mill Road. It was the site of an old printing plant that had been demolished. Patrick was put in charge of the new building's interior and hired the South African architect Clive Wilkinson, who had designed the converted Chiat Day warehouse in L.A. for the job. The central motif of the design was once again the sacred geometry of the circle. Desks were arranged in large circular patterns rippling out from circular glass conference rooms in the center. The carpeting followed the same circular patterns. In the building's lobby, interlocking rings of brass were embedded in the floor's terrazzo tiles to form the Flower of Life symbol. Elizabeth's new corner office was designed to look like the Oval Office. Patrick ordered a custom-made desk that was as deep as the president's at its center, but had rounded edges. In front of it, he arranged two sofas and two armchairs around a table, replicating the White House layout. At Elizabeth's insistence, the office's big windows were made of bulletproof glass. Patrick wasn't just Elizabeth's style and decor consultant. He also spearheaded a big marketing push Theranos was making in Arizona, where its wellness centers had expanded to 40 Walgreens stores. He hired Errol Morris, an Academy Award-winning documentary filmmaker who moonlighted as a producer and director of commercials to make video ads the company ran on TV stations in the Phoenix area and on its website and YouTube channel. One of the spots was a close-up of Elizabeth in her customary black turtleneck, staring into the camera and talking about what she called people's basic human right to access their own health information through blood tests. Her eyes looked so big, and she spoke so slowly and deliberately that the video had a hypnotic quality to it. Another spot featured patients complaining about how much they hated big needles, and then acting pleased at the painlessness of the Theranos experience as they got their fingers pricked. Patrick thought it was powerful and arranged for it to run during shows with high female viewership, like the ABC drama Scandal, because research had shown that mothers were households' medical decision-makers. But the ad had to be pulled a couple of weeks after it started airing, because a local doctor complained that some of his patients had gone to Walgreens stores expecting a fingerstick draw, only to be told their tests required a needle after all. Patrick was disappointed, but didn't raise a fuss about it because he knew this was a sensitive subject. Several months earlier, he had asked Sonny what proportion of Theranos tests were performed with fingerstick draws versus regular venous ones. Sonny had refused to give him a straight answer and had abruptly changed the subject. Chapter 18. The Hippocratic Oath. Alan Beam, Theranos's laboratory director, was late to the party. A white tent had been set up on basketball courts next to the old Facebook building, which the company was in the process of vacating. Music was blaring from big outdoor speakers, and lights projected images of giant pink spiders onto the makeshift dance floor. The grass field behind the tent was decorated with pumpkins and bales of hay. As he breathed in the cooling evening air of Palo Alto's Indian summer, Alan scanned the costumed crowd and caught sight of Elizabeth. She was wearing a long velvet dress with gold trim and a big upright collar, and her blonde hair was done up in an elaborate bun. The irony of her Queen Elizabeth attire wasn't lost on him. With a net worth that Forbes had just estimated at $4.5 billion, in its October 20, 2014 issue, she had become Silicon Valley royalty. Elizabeth loved to throw company parties, and none more so than the one she organized every year for Halloween. It was a Theranos tradition for which no expense was spared. The company's senior executives all played along. Sonny was dressed as an Arab sheikh. Daniel Young was Walter White, the high school chemistry teacher turned drug dealer from the show Breaking Bad. Christian Holmes and the Frat Pack were characters from Quentin Tarantino's Kill Bill movies. Ordinarily stiff and aloof at the office, Elizabeth liked to let loose on these occasions. At last year's party, she jumped up and down in a bouncy house like an excited child. This year, the bouncy house was replaced by an inflatable boxing ring. While employees wearing sumo suits and oversized boxing gloves wobbled around in it, Elizabeth was delighting in the costume of an engineer disguised as a giant neutrophil. Alan was supposed to be a zombie, and he felt like one. In retrospect, leaving his tranquil post in Pittsburgh to come work at Theranos had been like crossing into his own strange version of the Twilight Zone. For his first few months as laboratory director, he'd clung to the belief that the company was going to transform lab testing with its technology. But the past year's events had shattered any illusion of that. He now felt like a pawn in a dangerous game being played with patients, investors, and regulators. At one point, he'd had to talk Sonny and Elizabeth out of running HIV tests on diluted finger stick samples. Unreliable potassium and cholesterol results were bad enough. False HIV results would have been disastrous. His co-director, Mark Pandori, had quit after just 5 months on the job. The trigger had been a request he'd made that Elizabeth check in with them before making representations to the press about Theranos' testing capabilities. Sonny had summarily rejected it, prompting Mark to hand in his resignation that very day. Another member of the lab had been so troubled by some of the company's practices that she told Alan she couldn't sleep at night. She, too, had resigned. Alan was reaching his own breaking point. A few weeks earlier, he'd started forwarding dozens of work emails to his personal Gmail account. He knew forwarding the emails was a risky move because the company monitored everything, but he wanted to keep a record of the concerns he'd repeatedly raised with Sonny and Elizabeth. He'd gone a step further 2 days earlier and called a law firm in Washington, D.C. that specialized in representing corporate whistleblowers, but the person who answered the phone was a client services specialist. He opted to keep the reason for his call vague, wanting to speak only to an attorney. He did send them one of his email exchanges with Sonny, but he worried it was hard to understand without additional context and a good understanding of how clinical laboratories operate. It was also hard to prove everything. The company kept things so compartmentalized. Why wasn't he being shown quality control data anymore? How could a lab director, the person who was supposed to vouch for the accuracy of the test results delivered to doctors and patients, be denied that information? His other big concern was proficiency testing. After reading up on the CLIA regulations, he'd become convinced that Theranos was gaming the exercise.
Alan!
Daniel Young had sidled up next to him, interrupting his somber thoughts. As was his habit at these work parties, Daniel was drunk. The alcohol made him uncharacteristically friendly and approachable, but Alan knew better than to share his misgivings. Daniel was part of the inner circle. They made small talk, bantering about Daniel's upper-crust upbringing in Connecticut. As they chatted, the festivities seemed to be winding down. Some colleagues were headed to Antonio's Nut House, a dive bar a few blocks down the street, to have a few more beers. Alan and Daniel tagged along. When they got to the bar, Alan spotted Curtis Schneider, a scientist on the R&D side of the company, and grabbed a stool beside him. Curtis was one of the smartest people Alan knew at Theranos. He had a PhD in inorganic chemistry and had spent 4 years as a postdoctoral scholar at Caltech. They talked about fly fishing for a while. It was one of Curtis's favorite hobbies. Then Curtis told Alan about a conference call earlier that day with officials from the FDA. Theranos was trying to get the agency to approve some of its proprietary blood tests. During the call, one of the agency's reviewers voiced a dissenting view about the company's submission but was silenced by his colleagues. Curtis found it odd. There might be nothing to it, Alan thought, but the story added to his mounting unease. He told Curtis about the lab's quality control data and how it was being kept from him. And he confided something else. The company was cheating on proficiency testing. In case Curtis hadn't registered the implication of what he'd just said, he spelled it out. Theranos was breaking the law. When he looked up, Alan saw that Young was staring at them from across the bar. His face was white as a ghost's. 3 weeks later, Alan was sitting in his new office in Newark when he got a call from Christian Holmes. Most of the company had moved to the new building on Page Mill Road in Palo Alto, but not the clinical laboratory. The lab had moved across San Francisco Bay to Theranos' sprawling Newark facility, where it planned to one day manufacture thousands of mini-labs. Christian wanted Alan to handle yet another doctor's complaint. Alan had fielded dozens of them since the company had gone live with its tests the previous fall. Time and time again, he'd been asked to convince physicians that blood test results he had no confidence in were sound and accurate. He decided he couldn't do it anymore. His conscience wouldn't allow him to. He told Christian no and emailed Sonny and Elizabeth to inform them that he was resigning and to ask them to immediately take his name off the lab's CLIA license. Elizabeth replied that she was deeply disappointed. He agreed to delay his official departure by another month to give Theranos time to find a new lab director. For the first 2 weeks of his notice period, Alan went on vacation. He rode his motorcycle to Los Angeles to see his brother for a few days, and then flew to New York to spend Thanksgiving with his parents. When he returned in mid-December, he headed to the new Palo Alto headquarters to discuss a transition plan with Sonny. Sonny came down with Mona to meet him in the lobby of the new building. They ushered him into a room off the reception area and informed him he was being terminated early. Sonny slid what looked like a legal document across the table toward him. Alan read the bold heading at the top, Affidavit of Alan Beam. It stated, under penalty of perjury under the laws of California, that he promised to never disclose any proprietary or confidential information learned during his employment at the company. And it included this line, I do not have any electronic or hard copy information relating to Theranos in my possession in any location, including personal email accounts, any personal laptops or desktops, trash, deleted folders, USB drives, home, car, or any other location. Before Alan had time to finish reading, he heard Sonny say in an icy tone, We know you sent yourself a bunch of work emails. You have to let Mona access your Gmail account so that she can go through them and delete them. Alan refused. He told Sonny the company had no right to invade his privacy and he wouldn't sign any more documents. Sonny's face reddened. His volcanic temper was building. Shaking his head in disgust, he turned to Mona and said, Can you believe this guy? He turned back to Alan. Contempt oozing from his voice, he offered to hire him an attorney to expedite matters. The notion that a lawyer in the pay of Theranos would adequately defend his interests in a dispute with the company struck Alan as absurd. He declined the offer and announced that he wanted to leave. Mona gave him his backpack, which he'd insisted she retrieve from the lab. In return, she asked for his company phone and laptop. He handed them over after quickly resetting the phone to factory settings to wipe it of its contents. Then he walked out. Over the next few days, the messages piled up in his voicemail box. Some were from Sonny, others from Mona. They all said the same thing in increasingly threatening tones. He needed to come back to the office, let Mona delete the emails from his personal email account, and sign the affidavit, or else the company would sue him. Alan realized that they weren't going to stop. He needed a lawyer. Contacts with that Washington firm had gone nowhere. He needed someone local he could consult in person. He called the first listing that came up in a Google search, a medical malpractice and personal injury attorney in San Francisco. She agreed to represent him after he paid her a $10,000 retainer. As his new lawyer saw it, Alan didn't have much of a choice. Theranos could make a case that his actions did breach his confidential obligations, and even if it failed to do so, it could tie him up in court for months, if not years. This was one of the most valuable private companies in Silicon Valley, one of the fabled unicorns. Its financial resources were virtually limitless. The litigation could bankrupt him. Did he really want to take that risk? His lawyer was getting pressure from a Boy Schiller partner who was representing Theranos, and she was clearly intimidated. She urged Alan to delete the emails and to sign the affidavit. She told him she would send Theranos a preservation order instructing it to keep the originals. There was no assurance the company would honor it, but that was the best they could do, she said. That evening, Alan glumly sat down at his computer in his apartment in Santa Clara and logged into his Gmail account. One by one, he erased the emails. By the time he was done, he'd counted 175 of them. It had been 9 months since Richard Fuse had settled with Theranos and agreed to withdraw his patent, but he was still consumed with the case. For the first few weeks after the settlement, he'd been nearly catatonic. His wife, Lorraine, had to call his son, Joe, to find out what had happened, because he refused to talk about it. During the litigation, Fuse had found a friendly ear in Phyllis Gardner, a longtime friend who was a professor at Stanford's medical school. Phyllis and her husband, Andrew Perlman, had briefly been involved with Theranos during its infancy, because Elizabeth had consulted Phyllis about her original patch idea when she dropped out of Stanford. After telling her she didn't think her concept was remotely feasible, Phyllis had referred Elizabeth to Andrew, a veteran biotech industry executive. Andrew had agreed to serve on a short-lived Theranos advisory board that Elizabeth had dissolved after just a few months. The decade-old episode had left Phyllis skeptical that Elizabeth, who had no medical or scientific training to speak of, and a clear tendency not to listen to people who were older and more experienced, had really gone on to develop groundbreaking blood testing technology. Her suspicions had deepened when Andrew had chatted with a Siemens sales representative during a flight and learned that Theranos was a major purchaser of Siemens diagnostic equipment. Fuse, too, had become doubtful that Theranos could really do what it claimed. During a visit to Palo Alto for pre-trial motions in the fall of 2013, he'd called the local Walgreens and asked if he could have a creatinine fingerstick test done there. His doctors had recently diagnosed him with aldosteronism, a hormonal disorder that causes high blood pressure, and wanted him to monitor his creatinine levels for any sign of kidney damage. Creatinine is a common blood test, but the woman who answered the phone told him the wellness center didn't offer it without a special approval from Theranos' CEO. When he added that to the company's intense secrecy and to the fact that it had actively discouraged Ian Gibbons from testifying before he died, he smelled a rat. Fuse had introduced Phyllis to Ian's widow, Rochelle, and the two women had bonded over their distrust of Elizabeth. Together, the three of them formed a little band of Theranos skeptics. The problem was that no one else seemed to share their doubts. That would change when, in its December 15, 2014 issue, The New Yorker published a profile of Elizabeth. In many ways, it was just a longer version of the fortune story that had rocketed her to fame 6 months earlier. The difference this time was that someone knowledgeable about blood testing read it and was immediately dubious. That someone was Adam Clapper, a practicing pathologist in Columbia, Missouri, who in his spare time wrote a blog about the industry called Pathology Blog. To Clapper, it all sounded too good to be true, especially Theranos's supposed ability to run dozens of tests on just a drop of blood pricked from a finger. The New Yorker article did strike some skeptical notes. It included quotes from a senior scientist at Quest who said he didn't think fingerstick blood tests could be reliable, and it noted Theranos's lack of published, peer-reviewed data. Among the arguments she marshaled to rebut the latter point, Elizabeth cited a paper she had co-authored in a medical journal called Hematology Reports. Clapper had never heard of Hematology Reports before, so he looked into it. He learned that it was an online-only publication based in Italy that charged scientists who wanted to publish in it a $500 fee. He then looked up the paper Holmes had co-authored and was shocked to see that it included data for just one blood test from a grand total of 6 patients. In a post on his blog about the New Yorker story, Clapper pointed out the medical journal's obscurity and the flimsiness of the study and declared himself a skeptic. "Until I see evidence Theranos can deliver what it says it can deliver in terms of diagnostic accuracy." Pathology Blog didn't exactly have a big readership, but Joe Fuse came across the post in a Google search and brought it to his father's attention. Richard Fuse immediately got in touch with Clapper and told him he was on to something. He put him in contact with Phyllis and Rochelle and urged him to listen to what they had to say. Clapper was intrigued by what the three of them told him, especially by the story of Ian Gibbons's death. But it all sounded too circumstantial to go beyond what he'd already written. What he needed was some sort of proof, he told Fuse. Fuse was frustrated. What would it take for people to listen to him and finally see through Elizabeth Holmes? While checking his email a few days later, Fuse saw a notification from LinkedIn alerting him that someone new had looked up his profile on the site. The viewer's name, Alan Beam, didn't ring a bell, but his job title got Fuse's attention: Laboratory Director at Theranos. Fuse sent Beam a message through the site's in-mail feature, asking if they could talk on the phone. He thought the odds of getting a response were very low, but it was worth a try. He was in Malibu taking photos with his old Leica camera the next day when a short reply from Beam appeared in his iPhone inbox. He was willing to talk, and he included his cell phone number. Fuse drove his black Mercedes E-Class sedan back to Beverly Hills and, when he was just a few blocks from home, dialed the number. The voice he heard on the other end of the line sounded terrified. "Dr. Fuse, the reason I'm willing to talk to you is you're a physician," Beam said. "You and I took the Hippocratic Oath, which is to first do no harm. Theranos is putting people in harm's way." Alan proceeded to tell Fuse about a litany of problems in the Theranos lab. Fuse pulled into his driveway and quickly got out of his car. As soon as he was inside his house, he grabbed a notepad he'd brought back from a stay at a hotel in Paris called Le Maurice and started taking notes. Alan was speaking so fast that he was having trouble keeping up with what he was saying. He jotted down, "Lied to CLIA people and cheated. Rollout disaster. Finger stick not accurate, using venipuncture. Transporting Arizona to Palo Alto, using Siemens equip. Ethical breaches. False thyroid results. K results all over map. False pregnancy errors. Told Eliz not ready, but insisted proceed." Fuse asked Alan to talk to Joe and to Phyllis. He wanted them to hear it for themselves from the horse's mouth. Alan agreed to call them and more or less repeated to each of them what he had told Fuse. But that was all he was willing to do. He wouldn't talk to anyone else. Boyce Schiller lawyers had been hounding him, he said, and he couldn't afford to be sued like Fuse had been. Although he sympathized with Alan's predicament, Fuse couldn't just leave it at that. He got back in touch with Clapper and told him about the new connection he had made and what he'd learned. This was the proof he'd been asking for, he told him. Clapper agreed that this changed everything. The story now had legs, but he decided he couldn't take it on himself. For one thing, he couldn't shoulder the legal liability of going up against a $9 billion Silicon Valley company with a litigious track record that was represented by David Boyce. For another, he was just an amateur blogger. He didn't have the journalistic know-how to tackle something like this, not to mention the fact that he had a full-time medical practice to tend to. This, he thought, was a job for an investigative reporter. In the 3 years since he'd launched Pathology Blog, Clapper had spoken to several about lab industry abuses. There was one in particular who came to mind. He worked for the Wall Street Journal. Chapter 19. The Tip. It was the second Monday in February, and I was sitting at my messy desk at the Wall Street Journal's Midtown Manhattan newsroom, casting about for a new story to sink my teeth into. I'd recently finished work on a year-long investigation of Medicare fraud and had no idea what to do next. After 16 years at the Journal, this was something I still hadn't mastered: the art of swiftly and efficiently transitioning from one investigative project to the next. My phone rang. It was Adam from Pathology Blog. I'd sought his help 8 months earlier when I was trying to understand the complexities of laboratory billing for one of my stories in the Medicare series. He'd patiently explained to me what lab procedures certain billing codes corresponded to, knowledge I'd later used to expose a scam at a big operator of cancer treatment centers. Adam told me he'd stumbled across what he thought could be a big story. People often come to journalists with tips. 9 times out of 10, they don't pan out, but I always took the time to listen. You never knew. Besides, at this particular moment, I was like a dog without a bone. I needed a new bone to chew on. Adam asked if I'd read a recent feature in The New Yorker about a Silicon Valley prodigy named Elizabeth Holmes and her company, Theranos. As it turned out, I had. I subscribed to the magazine and often read it on the subway to and from work. Now that he mentioned it, there were some things I'd read in that article that I'd found suspect. The lack of any peer-reviewed data to back up the company's scientific claims was one of them. I'd reported about healthcare issues for the better part of a decade and couldn't think of any serious advances in medicine that hadn't been subject to peer review. I'd also been struck by a brief description Holmes had given of the way her secret blood testing devices worked. A chemistry is performed so that a chemical reaction occurs and generates a signal from the chemical interaction with the sample, which is translated into a result, which is then reviewed by certified laboratory personnel. Those sounded like the words of a high school chemistry student, not a sophisticated laboratory scientist. The New Yorker writer had called the description comically vague. When I stopped to think about it, I found it hard to believe that a college dropout with just 2 semesters of chemical engineering courses under her belt had pioneered cutting-edge new science. Sure, Mark Zuckerberg had learned to code on his father's computer when he was 10, but medicine was different. It wasn't something you could teach yourself in the basement of your house. You needed years of formal training and decades of research to add value. There was a reason many Nobel laureates in medicine were in their 60s when their achievements were recognized. Adam said that he'd had a similar reaction to the New Yorker piece, and that a group of people had contacted him after he'd posted a skeptical item on his blog about it. He was cryptic about their identities and their connection to Theranos at first, but he said they had information about the company I'd want to hear. He said he'd check with them to see if they were willing to talk to me. In the meantime, I did some preliminary research on Theranos and came across the Journal's editorial page piece from 17 months earlier. I hadn't seen it when it was published. This added an interesting wrinkle, I thought. My newspaper had played a role in Holmes's meteoric rise by being the first mainstream media organization to publicize her supposed achievements. It made for an awkward situation, but I wasn't too worried about it. There was a firewall between the journal's editorial and newsroom staffs. If it turned out that I found some skeletons in Holmes's closet, it wouldn't be the first time the two sides of the paper had contradicted each other. 2 weeks after our initial conversation, Adam put me in touch with Richard and Joe Fuse, Phyllis Gardner, and Rochelle Gibbons. It was disappointing at first to hear that the Fuses had been involved in litigation with Theranos. Even if they insisted they'd been wrongly accused, the lawsuit gave them a big axe to grind and made them useless as sources. But my ears pricked up when I heard that they had talked to Theranos's just-departed laboratory director and that he was alleging some sort of wrongdoing at the company. I also found the story of Ian Gibbons tragic and was intrigued by the fact that Rochelle said he'd confided to her on several occasions that the Theranos technology wasn't working. It was the type of thing that would have been dismissed as hearsay in court, but it seemed credible enough to merit a closer look. In order to take this any further, though, what I needed to do next was clear. I needed to talk to Alan Beam. The first half dozen times I dialed Alan's number, I got his voicemail. I didn't leave a message, and instead resolved to just keep trying him. On the afternoon of Thursday, February 26th, 2015, a voice with an accent I couldn't quite place finally answered the phone. After ascertaining that it was, in fact, Alan, I introduced myself and told him I understood he had recently left Theranos with concerns about the way the company was operating. I could sense he was very nervous, but he also seemed to want to unburden himself. He told me he would speak to me only if I promised to keep his identity confidential. Theranos's lawyers had been harassing him, and he was certain the company would sue him if it found out he was talking to a reporter. I agreed to grant him anonymity. It wasn't a hard decision. Without him, all I had were second-hand sources and informed speculation. If he wouldn't talk, there would be no story. With the ground rules for our conversation established, Alan let down his guard, and we talked for more than an hour. One of the first things he said was that what Ian had told Rochelle was true. The Theranos devices didn't work. They were called Edisons, he said, and were error-prone. They constantly failed quality control. Furthermore, Theranos used them for only a small number of tests. It performed most of its tests on commercially available instruments and diluted the blood samples. It took me a while to understand the dilution part. Why would they do that, and why was it bad? I asked. Alan explained that it was to make up for the fact that the Edison could only do a category of tests known as immunoassays. Theranos didn't want people to know its technology was limited, so it had contrived a way of running small fingerstick samples on conventional machines. This involved diluting the fingerstick samples to make them bigger. The problem, he said, was that when you diluted the samples, you lowered the concentration of analytes in the blood to a level the conventional machines could no longer measure accurately. He said he had tried to delay the launch of Theranos's blood tests in Walgreens stores and had warned Holmes that the lab's sodium and potassium results were completely unreliable. According to Theranos's tests, perfectly healthy patients had levels of potassium in their blood that were off the charts. He used the word crazy to describe the results. I was barely getting my head around these revelations when Alan mentioned something called proficiency testing. He was adamant that Theranos was breaking federal proficiency testing rules. He even referred me to the relevant section of the Code of Federal Regulations, 42 CFR, Part 493. I wrote it down in my notebook and told myself to look it up later. Alan also said that Holmes was evangelical about revolutionizing blood testing, but that her knowledge base in science and medicine was poor, confirming my instincts. He said she wasn't the one running Theranos day to day. A man named Sonny Balwani was. Alan didn't mince his words about Balwani. He was a dishonest bully who managed through intimidation. Then he dropped another bombshell. Holmes and Balwani were romantically involved. I knew from reading the New Yorker and Fortune articles and from browsing the Theranos website that Balwani was the company's president and chief operating officer. If what Alan was saying was true, this added a new twist. Silicon Valley's first female billionaire tech founder was sleeping with her number two executive, who was nearly 20 years her senior. It was sloppy corporate governance, but then again, this was a private company. There were no rules against that sort of thing in Silicon Valley's private startup world. What I found more interesting was the fact that Holmes seemed to be hiding the relationship from her board. Why else would the New Yorker article have portrayed her as single, with Henry Kissinger telling the magazine that he and his wife had tried to fix her up on dates? If Holmes wasn't forthright with her board about her relationship with Balwani, then what else might she be keeping from it? Alan said he had raised his concerns about proficiency testing and the reliability of Theranos' test results with Holmes and Balwani a number of times in person and by email. But Balwani would always either rebuff him or put him off, making sure to copy a Theranos lawyer on their email exchanges and to write, "Consider this attorney-client confidential." As the laboratory director whose name had been on the Theranos Labs CLIA license, Alan was worried that he would be held personally responsible if there was ever a government investigation. To protect himself, he told me he'd forwarded dozens of his email exchanges with Balwani to his personal email account. But Theranos had found that out and threatened to sue him for breaching his confidentiality agreement. What worried him even more than any personal liability he might face was the potential harm patients were being exposed to. He described the two nightmare scenarios false blood test results could lead to. A false positive might cause a patient to have an unnecessary medical procedure, but a false negative was worse. A patient with a serious condition that went undiagnosed could die. I hung up the phone, feeling the familiar rush I got whenever I made a big reporting breakthrough, and had to remind myself that this was just the first step in a long process. There was still a lot to understand, and, above all, the story would require corroboration. There was no way the paper would take it with just one anonymous source, however good that source might be. The next time Alan and I talked, I was standing in Brooklyn's Prospect Park, trying to stay warm, while keeping a loose eye on my two boys, ages 9 and 11, as they horsed around with one of their friends. It was the last Saturday in what would go down in the record books as New York City's coldest February in 81 years. I had texted Alan after our first conversation to ask if he could think of former colleagues who might corroborate what he'd told me. He'd sent 7 names, and I'd made contact with 2 of them. Both had been extremely nervous and had only agreed to talk on deep background. One of them, a former Theranos CLS, wouldn't say much, but what she did say gave me confidence that I was on the right track. She told me she had been very troubled by what was going on at the company and concerned for patient safety. She'd resigned because she wasn't comfortable having her name continue to appear on test results. The other was a former technical supervisor in the lab who'd said that Theranos operated under a culture of secrecy and fear. I told Alan that I felt like I was beginning to make progress, which he seemed pleased to hear. I asked him whether he had kept the emails he'd forwarded to his personal Gmail account. My heart sank when he responded that his lawyer had made him delete them to comply with the affidavit the company made him sign. Documentary evidence was the gold standard for these types of stories. This would make my job much more difficult. I tried not to betray my disappointment. Our conversation shifted to proficiency testing. Alan explained how Theranos was gaming it, and he told me which commercial analyzers it used for the majority of its blood tests. Both were made by Siemens, confirming what Andrew Perlman, Phyllis Gardner's husband, had heard from a Siemens sales representative during a flight. He revealed something else that hadn't come up in our first call. Theranos's lab was divided into two parts. One contained the commercial analyzers, and the other the Edison devices. During her inspection of the lab, a state inspector had been shown only the part with the commercial analyzers. Alan felt she'd been deceived. He also mentioned that Theranos was working on a newer generation device codenamed 4S that was supposed to supplant the Edison and do a broader variety of blood tests, but it didn't work at all and was never deployed in the lab. Diluting fingerstick samples and running them on Siemens machines was supposed to be a temporary solution, but it had become a permanent one because the 4S had turned into a fiasco. It was all beginning to make sense. Holmes and her company had overpromised and then cut corners when they couldn't deliver. It was one thing to do that with software or a smartphone app, but doing it with a medical product that people relied on to make important health decisions was unconscionable. Toward the end of this second phone conversation, Alan mentioned something else I found of interest. George Shultz, the former Secretary of State, who was a Theranos board member, had a grandson named Tyler, who had worked at the company. Alan wasn't sure why Tyler had left, but he didn't think it was on good terms. I was jotting things down in the Notes app of my iPhone and added Tyler's name as another potential source. Over the next few weeks, I made some more progress, but I also encountered some complications. In my quest to corroborate what Alan was telling me, I contacted more than 20 current and former Theranos employees. Many didn't reply to my calls and emails. The few that I managed to get on the phone told me they had signed ironclad confidentiality agreements and didn't want to risk being sued for violating them. One former high-ranking lab employee did agree to talk to me, but only off the record. This was an important journalistic distinction. Alan and the other two former employees had agreed to speak to me on deep background, which meant I could use what they told me while keeping their identities confidential. Off the record meant I couldn't make any use of the information. The conversation was nonetheless helpful because this source confirmed a lot of what Alan had told me, giving me the confidence to forge on. He summed up what was going on at the company with an analogy. The way Theranos is operating is like trying to build a bus while you're driving the bus. Someone is going to get killed. A few days later, Alan got back in touch with some good news. I had asked him to call the Washington, D.C. whistleblower law firm he'd reached out to in the fall to see if he could retrieve the email exchange with Balwani he had sent to it. The firm had just complied with his request. Alan forwarded the exchange to me. It was a chain of 18 emails about proficiency testing between Sonny Balwani, Daniel Young, Mark Pandori, and Alan. It showed Balwani angrily admonishing Alan and Mark Pandori for running the proficiency testing samples on the Edison and reluctantly acknowledging that the device had failed the test. Moreover, it left no doubt that Holmes knew about the incident. She was copied on most of the emails. This was another step forward, but it was soon followed by a step backward. In late March, Alan got cold feet. He stood by everything he'd told me, but he no longer wanted to be involved with the story going forward. He couldn't stomach the risks anymore. Talking to me gave him palpitations and distracted him from his new job, he said. I tried to get him to change his mind, but he was resolute, so I decided to give him some space and hoped he would eventually come around. Although it was a big setback, I was slowly making headway on other fronts. Wanting a neutral opinion from a lab expert about Theranos' dilution of blood samples and the way it conducted proficiency testing, I called Timothy Hamill, vice chairman of the University of California, San Francisco's Department of Laboratory Medicine. Tim confirmed to me that both practices were highly questionable. He also explained the pitfalls of using blood pricked from a finger. Unlike venous blood drawn from the arm, capillary blood was polluted by fluids from tissues and cells that interfered with tests and made measurements less accurate. I'd be less surprised if they told us they were time travelers who came back from the 27th century than if they told us they cracked that nut, he said. Before his change of heart, Alan had mentioned a nurse in Arizona named Carmen Washington, who worked at a clinic owned by Walgreens and had complained about Theranos' blood tests. After trying to track her down for several weeks, I finally got her on the phone. She told me three of her patients had received questionable results from the company. One was a 16-year-old girl with a sky-high potassium result that suggested she was at risk of a heart attack. The result hadn't made sense, given that she was a teenager and in good health, Carmen said. Two other patients had received results showing abnormally high levels of thyroid-stimulating hormone, or TSH. Carmen had called them back into the clinic and redrawn their blood. The second time, their results had come back abnormally low. After that, Carmen had lost faith in Theranos' fingerstick tests. These incidents tracked with Alan's claims. TSH was one of the immunoassays Theranos performed on the Edison that had failed proficiency testing. Carmen Washington's story was helpful, but I soon had something better. Another Theranos whistleblower. I had dropped Tyler Schultz a note through LinkedIn's in-mail messaging feature after noticing that he had viewed my profile on the site. I figured he must have heard from other former employees that I was poking around. It had been more than a month since I'd made the overture, and I was losing hope that he would reply when my phone rang. It was Tyler, and he seemed eager to talk. However, he was extremely worried that Theranos would come after him. He was calling me from a burner phone that couldn't be traced back to him. After I agreed to grant him confidentiality, he told me in broad strokes the story of his 8 months at the company. Tyler's motivation for talking to me was twofold. Like Alan, he was worried about patients getting inaccurate test results. He was also concerned for his grandfather's reputation. Although he felt certain Theranos would eventually be exposed, he wanted to hasten the process to give his grandfather the chance to clear his name. George Schultz was 94 and might not be around all that much longer. He made it through Watergate and the Iran-Contra scandal with his integrity intact, Tyler told me. I'm sure he'll get through Theranos if he's still alive to make things right. On his way out the door, Tyler had printed his emails to Holmes and Balwani's response and smuggled them out under his shirt. He also still had the emails he'd exchanged with the New York State Health Department about proficiency testing. This was music to my ears. I asked him to send me everything, which he promptly did. It was time to head to Palo Alto. But before going, there was somewhere else I wanted to visit first. I needed to prove that the company was producing inaccurate blood test results. The only way to do that was to find doctors who had received questionable lab reports and sent their patients to get retested elsewhere. The best place to go looking was Phoenix, where Theranos had expanded to more than 40 locations. My first thought had been to pay a visit to Carmen Washington, but she'd left the Walgreens clinic she worked at on the corner of Osborne Road and Central Avenue and didn't have the names of the three patients she'd told me about. I had another lead, though, after scanning Yelp to see if anyone had complained about a bad experience with Theranos. Sure enough, a woman who appeared to be a doctor and went by Natalie M. had. Yelp has a feature that allows you to send messages to reviewers, so I sent her a note with my contact information. She called me the next day. Natalie M.'s real name was Nicole Sundin. She was a family practitioner.